Welcome to the Open Book Podcast. What you're about to hear is a recording of a live event that took place at the September 2025 edition of the Open Book Festival. In this event, called Banging on the Walls of the Tank, Haidar Eid speaks to Yusuf Chikta about his new book, a collection of essays and articles he wrote and published during the Israeli onslaught on Gaza. Here's their conversation.
Thank you, Haidar, for that film. It's very difficult, I think, for all of us, for you as an author. How does one write in a time of genocide? And for us, the audience, how do we read? What do we do? What is there to be done to stop this genocide? You've said in the book that it's 100 weeks tomorrow of genocide, the most recent genocide. And you spoke about the genocide before. It is now proclaimed as a genocide by several other commentators, International Association of Genocide Scholars. You've said in the book that this genocide has changed you in so many ways. You're not the same person anymore. Can I add to that, that this genocide has changed the world? It has changed everything. It has rendered the Universal Declaration of Human Rights less profound. It was shredded by the Israeli ambassador. The idea of equality, everybody being born equal, and everybody entitled to the same dignity, that doesn't apply to people in the global south, and particularly to the Palestinians, and we're fighting back. But there's something about this film where you quote in the book, it's a revolutionary optimism. The pessimism of the intellect versus the optimism of the will. But tell us about how it has affected you and how it has affected the world. And we're going to end off, but what needs to be done to change that? You know, one of your articles on the 15th of October 2023, you make the call, from Gaza, we ask you to stand up against genocide. How do we stand up? Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Yusuf. I think before I start, I always, you know, since the 7th of October, I have every single time people invite me to talk, whether about the book or the other book that we launched last year here also, I always open by paying tribute to 39 colleagues of mine whom we've lost from Al-Aqsa University, and to more than 288 students, including Khalil Abu Yahya, my own student who shot this documentary in Gaza. And I also pay tribute to 65 of my relatives' cousins, and to more than 200,000 people whom we have lost over the last 2 years in Gaza. According to the official figures released by the Palestinian Ministry of Health, we've lost about 63,000 people since the 7th, 63,000 people since the 7th of October. But that is an underestimation, in fact, because according to Haaretz, a newspaper which is an Israeli, mainstream Israeli paper, we've lost more than 100,000 since the 7th of October. And according to research conducted by Harvard University, the figure is shocking, in fact, even though I don't like to talk about numbers and figures, because every single person has a story to tell, has a family that he or she loves, has sons, daughters, etc. And I'm talking about whole families being wiped out, including some of my cousins' families. According to Harvard, we've lost more than 377,000. And the population of Gaza is 2.3 million. So let that sink in. So, you know, just to answer your question directly, yes, 7th of October has changed us. I mean, I am not the same person. Since the 7th of October, I have been displaced together with my family five times. And in Gaza itself, I was, again, together with my family, my small family, two little daughters and my wife, we were displaced three times. We lost everything, the house, the car, every single thing that you can think of. But again, this is nothing compared to what the people in Gaza are going through right now. And I remember very well, you've read the book, Yusuf. I was in Gaza in 2000, and at the end of 2008, when genocidal Israel decided to launch a massive attack against Gaza, killing within 18 days, killing more than 1,200 people, including, you know, more than 400 children. And I didn't want to leave Gaza at the time. And I remember, you know, this, because I have dual citizenship, South African and Palestinian, the South African embassy in Ramallah at the time contacted me, asking me if I wanted to leave, and I said no. I didn't have kids at the time. In 2012, I was also there. For a week, Israel launched another massive attack because Israel knew very well that it could get away with murder, because the world refused to intervene, refused to impose sanctions. I am a member of the BDS campaign. I'm a co-founder of the BDS movement. And I remember myself contributing to the issuance of statements calling on the international community to boycott apartheid Israel, to divest from apartheid Israel, and from international companies benefiting from Israel's war crimes and crimes against humanity, and imposing sanctions against it. Nothing happened. And this is why in 2014, apartheid Israel decided to do the same thing, launching another massive attack for 51 days, killing more than 2,400 people, 75% of whom were children and women. And what did the international community do? Absolutely nothing. The Great March of Return. I saw little kids being shot in the neck, in the legs. We issued another statement expecting the international community to do something, but it did absolutely nothing. And this is why this genocide is taking place right now.
Thank you. In terms of writing the book, why are we writing the book? I think John Polger, as you quote in the book, says something. What happens in Gaza is a defining moment of our time, which either grants us the impunity of war criminals, the impunity of our silence, while we contort our intellect and morality, or gives us the power to speak out.
Absolutely.
Now, we, as you know, we tried very hard, and you were very reluctant, and you were vacillating to come to South Africa, because we wanted somebody to tell the story those horrible years, months, and year in November, December 2023. And your journey was like an odyssey. You know, it was bombing, and I remember one of your daughters had a toothache, and your dentist was bombed. You mentioned his name. But that the authenticity of this book, the beauty of this book lies in its authenticity, in that you have humanized all those figures, that 200,000, 300,000. You have given a different meaning to the word rubble, and the disentanglement and the mangling of the human body. And tell us about the silence, the complicity, and why it is so necessary to have books like this, and the way in which we write it, from Palestinians, about Palestinians, and to hold the media in South Africa and globally to account for their complicity.
Yeah, no, thank you, Yusuf. I think just before I answer that question, I need also to mention that the book is dedicated to Hind Rajab. And the little child who's the same age as my little daughter, Salma, Hind Rajab was killed after her desperate call with the Red Crescent in Ramallah. She was trying to escape together with her family. They killed all her family, her little sister called the Red Crescent, and then she was shot dead, and Hind Rajab was left alone until she died.
After 365 bullets.
That's correct.
And there were instances of silence, and they asked her to speak, and she said she's got a dress on, and every time she speaks, the blood falls on the dress, and she doesn't want a mummy to wash that.
Yeah. You know, I didn't want to go into detail because it's a very traumatic experience, I must tell you, because she was killed behind my house. I mean, yeah, she was killed behind my house. I know exactly where she was killed. And I think it's important for people, to understand that we have a voice and we are agents. And to answer the question, most of the books that have been written about Gaza have been written by people living outside Gaza and who are not Palestinian. I mean, if you think about it, and I'm sure people will understand what I'm saying, how many books have you written, read, books that are written by Gazans, Palestinians living in Gaza? You can count one, you can count two. But I think, you know, it is important to understand that, yes, we need voices out of Gaza. My close friend Rifat al-Ar'ir, some of you already know the Palestinian poet, a colleague of mine, who was killed. He was threatened, and then he was killed together with his family, about 9 members of his family. He was killed because the Israelis did not want to hear any Palestinian voices coming out of Gaza. And the book, in fact, the idea of the book came to my mind after leaving Gaza. And I must say that it was inspired by Edward Said, the late Edward Said, Palestinian voice, Edward Said's call on us Palestinians to narrate our story, to narrate our narrative. One of my favorite pieces written by Edward Said is titled Permission to Narrate. Permission to Narrate, in which he calls on us Palestinians to take our struggle to the realm, the world of representation, because it's about the way we represent our struggle and the way we represent our suffering as well. And this is why we decided to produce this documentary, which was shot in Gaza by Khalil Abu Yahya, one of my former students, and who, after graduating from Al-Aqsa University, became a BDS activist and an advocate for one state, a secular democratic state, between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. So I think the importance of the book lies in the fact that it is written by somebody who was born in Gaza, who lived in Gaza. It has nothing to do with me as Haider Eid. It has everything to do with Hind Rajab and all the Palestinian children whose bodies remain under the rubble in Gaza.
And also about the issue around refugees. And what is the title of this book, Banging on the Walls of the Tank?
Well, this is the end of, the book was inspired by the works of Edward Said, but more importantly, actually, it was inspired by one of my role models personally, the Palestinian writer, novelist Ghassan Kanafani. His first novel, Novella, that was written in 1958 and published 3 years after that, ends with this question: why didn't you bang on the walls of the tank? The story of three Palestinian refugees representing the three Palestinian generations at the time, 10 years after the Nakba, the catastrophe, three Palestinians who want to be smuggled from Iraq into Kuwait. So they hide inside a tank of a lorry that is driven by a Palestinian driver. And on the border, they hide in the border between Iraq and Kuwait. They hide inside the tank and they suffocate. They die. And then when the driver discovers that, he just starts pulling his hair and keeps asking this question: why didn't you bang on the walls of the tank? Metaphorically speaking, it's a call for revolution. But at the same time, these three people, three Palestinians, in fact, banged on the wall of the tank, but the world was deaf. The world couldn't hear the banging on the walls of the tank. And this is what is exactly happening in Gaza right now.
And the world is still deaf. But Richard Falk, in his prologue, says the beauty of this book not only lies in its dissection of what is taking place, but you also consistently end off about the actions that we need to take. And you make a clarion call for BDS. You make a clarion call for the unity of the land, a clarion call for the resistance, a clarion call for leadership. And you just don't give up. Tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, thank you for asking this question. I think it's important for people who don't know that Palestinian civil society, almost all Palestinian civil society, there's an overwhelming, actually, endorsement of the BDS call that was issued back in 2005. I was in Palestine at the time. But before that, in 2004, a group of Palestinian academics, artists, cultural figures, came together and issued a statement calling on international universities after learning from the South African experience, in fact, calling on international universities, cultural institutions, etc., to boycott all Israeli academic institutions due to their complicity in Israel's violations of our basic human rights. So that was in 2004. But then in 2005, we managed to convince almost all representatives of Palestinian civil society sectors to issue the universal BDS call. Again, after we had studied the first South African BDS call in the late 50s, I think, a handful of ANC, SACP activists living in London came together and decided to issue a call calling on the international community to boycott the apartheid regime until it complied with international law. So the question was, and after discussing with the likes of the late Desmond Tutu, I personally sat with him, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, when he visited Gaza in 2006, heading an international commission of investigation. And I remember him telling me this. I mean, it took the international community more than 30 years to heed the call made by the oppressed of South Africa. If you remember, Yusuf, and I'm sure you and people our age would remember, in the mid-80s, Margaret Thatcher considered Mandela a terrorist. 1987, Ronald Reagan called the ANC a terrorist organization. In other words, it took the international community, as the late Archbishop Tutu said, more than 30 years to heed the call made by the oppressed South Africans. We learned from that experience. We've learned from that experience, and this is why we issued our call in 2005, and I'm telling you, as I said here in this documentary, this is our South African moment. And let me seize this opportunity, and I know we are running out of time very quickly, and say post-apartheid South Africa should not have any kind of diplomatic, cultural, economic ties with apartheid, genocidal Israel. At all, whatsoever. There is no justification whatsoever. This is number one. Number two, the last point, and I think you, of all peoples of the world, South Africans, know that the two-state solution is a racist solution par excellence. And what we are giving the oppressed, the colonized Palestinians, we are making a compromise by calling for a secular democratic state between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean, a state for all of its citizens, regardless of race, gender, ethnicity, et cetera, et cetera.
Thank you. And the resolution 194, the Great March of Return, has dissolved the two-state solution and the Oslo cause. Because what does the right to return mean? And how does it influence what you've just now articulated?
Very, very quickly, United Nations Resolution 194 calls for the return of all Palestinian refugees to the towns and villages from which they were ethnically cleansed. My parents, as you saw in that documentary, come from the village of Zarnouga. Both died in 2005, dreaming of the implementation of United Nations Resolution 194. If you ask my two little daughters, seven and 8 years old, where are you from? They wouldn't tell you we are from Gaza. They would say we are from Zarnouga.
Thank you. And that just emphasizes that we are not settling for a Bantustan state. We are settling for the unity of the land in Palestine as it existed in 1948.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you. You made reference to the parallels with South Africa, but Richard Falk makes the point, what we may be missing in this is in South Africa we dealt with national oppression, the liquidation of exploitation. But you're dealing with something else here. You're dealing also with a genocide. You're dealing with a displacement of Palestinians, replacement by Jews in terms of that. And you're also dealing with an imperialism which is hell-bent to preserve its plunder and pillaging of the region, and it's willing to recarve and recolonize that region. And the importance of that question in terms of what we must do outside, can you just elaborate on that, please?
Yeah, thank you. I think, you know, when Archbishop Tutu visited us in 2006, and actually other anti-apartheid activists visited us in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and since then we've been having all these discussions with them, almost all South African activists agree that what we are witnessing in Palestine is far worse than apartheid. What we are going through in Palestine, we in the BDS movement, we call it a multi-tiered system of oppression. Multi-tiered system of oppression. According to international law, I mean, this is not just a personal view. Number one, the occupation, direct military occupation of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank that took place in 1967 is illegal under international law, including the building and expansion of the existing illegal Israeli settlements. And all settlements are illegal under international law. So this is number one, so direct military occupation. Number two, there are similarities and differences between apartheid South Africa and apartheid Israel. There are more than 1.4 million Palestinians living as third-class citizens in Israel, Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel. And when we say apartheid Israel again, some Zionists get offended. Well, Israel's mainstream human rights organization, B'Tselem, calls it apartheid. Amnesty International calls it apartheid. Human Rights Watch calls it apartheid. And now, even B'Tselem, Israel's mainstream human rights organization, says what is happening right now in Gaza is genocide. Genocide is the mother of all crimes. It is worse than apartheid. Mm. Now, when you think about it, did your generation ever see F-16s, Apache helicopters, attacking black townships in South Africa under apartheid? What we are going through right now in Gaza is a deliberate starving of the people of Gaza. More than 3,000 people have died as a result of the deliberate starvation of the people of Gaza. The UN calls it famine. It is famine. Children of Gaza are being starved to death. Did that happen in South Africa? You know, because when people compare, but this is not to belittle or underestimate the suffering of the people of Gaza. No, not at all. But we're talking about similarities and differences and the lessons we can learn. You in South Africa relied on what you called the four pillars of struggle, Yusuf. The armed struggle, it was your right to fight against the apartheid regime. Nelson Mandela was arrested in 1964, accused of sabotage. Spent 27 years in jail. armed struggle. Two, political underground. Three, mass mobilization. Four, international solidarity and exactly. BDS. And we've tried all of that, Yusuf.
Quickly, before we get to that, you were part of the World Conference Against Racism in Durban, where we linked more firmly the question of apartheid and Israel and Zionism. But today's that is now common currency around that. But you've also got a chapter here on the Gaza Shoah and the banality of evil, the contestation around if it's a genocide, is it not? I mean, and you've pointed out in the book, which I think it has taken everybody else a long time to accept, that apartheid, herrenvolkism, and genocide and displacement and replacement was embedded early on, before 1948, in the Zionist psyche.
No, absolutely. I mean, when Israel was established, it was based on the idea of Zionism. And United Nations in the mid-70s, came up with a resolution equating Zionism with racism. Of course, after 1993, with the signing of the Oslo Accords, et cetera, people forgot about that. And I think it's important to understand that Israel is a settler colony. A settler colony exactly like Australia, like New Zealand, like the Americans. It is based on the idea of what Patrick Wolf calls the annihilation of the native. And right from the beginning, towards the end of the 19th century and throughout the 20th century, our very existence was denied, Yusuf. I mean, if you remember, after the 1967 war, Golda Meir, the Israeli prime minister at the time, when she was asked about the Palestinian people, she said, who? There is no such thing as a Palestinian people. It's not as if we came and we occupied. There was nothing here. It's an empty land, a land without a people, for a people without a land. And this is why our very existence in itself, Yusuf, is resistance. And this is what the heroic people of Gaza are going through. They are proving to the world that they exist, that they are human beings like every other person sitting here with us here, like every other people, like black South Africans, like white South Africans, like Americans, like Australians. And I think it is very important. The last point before we go to the floor is that I want to make it absolutely clear that what we expect, and when I say we Palestinians, especially Gazans, we expect the South African government to stop actually exporting, to stop enabling genocide. As much as we appreciate South African government taking Israel to the ICJ, still there is coal being exported from South Africa to apartheid Israel. Number two, did you know, and I'm sure some of you already know, that there are South African mercenaries serving in the Israeli occupation forces committing war crimes in Gaza? So what are you going to do about this?
Thank you, and we are going to interrogate that and give you an answer when we have them in court. We're fighting against time, but just very briefly, there was a book written, Eddie Rue, Time Longer Than Rope. And it's a Jamaican, it's a West Indian saying, when the slaves rebelled and they were hanged with a rope, they said, time is longer than the measurement of that rope. And that captures, in terms of a parallel, historically, the Sumud of the Palestinians. We won't give up. But we are racing against time as well. We've got 10 minutes for questioning, and then we're going to conclude, and we will have to get you back, Haider. So can we field some questions, very brief, or comments? And Abida, and I see Abida's hand.
I can't see. If you can turn on the light.
Abida's a trade unionist. Lynette is a media studies professor.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Comrade Haider and Yusuf. I think for me, I mean, the really to say, the first thing is that when I looked at the short video clip, we are actually in an area that is part of dyslexics, that people were forcibly removed from, right? I mean, I grew up in Manenberg, and then the people in our road we had, although it was Manenberg Avenue, some people were forcibly removed from Protea Village. That was Springfield Road, so that was the unofficial name of our road. Here we have the very iconic Hanover Street that was recently renamed because they named it. They also changed the names. It was Kaisergracht, but in 2019 they changed that. I was at school here at Trafalgar when I started my high schooling year. All the people, the flats were empty. The Bloemer Flats is now the best Western Cape Suites hotel. And the area was completely empty, but the only symbols that stood there were the churches and the mosque, and it's still like that. And our people have still not been relocated back to District 6, and it's not only District 6. We are spread out all across the Cape Flats, and we might not have what the Palestinian people are experiencing currently with the genocide, but we are still living the effects of that forced removals. Gangsterism and crime, where families have to bury people every day. For the last 2 months in black working class communities, at least 50 people per week are shot. So we do have a little bit of history, and that is, for me, is important that we link those struggles, because it's similar, but there are also differences. Yes, we might not have experienced the Apache helicopters, but we mustn't forget also the frontier wars in the Eastern Cape. So we've survived barely 400 years of genocide as well. And so that's why it's very important for us as South African and internationalists that we must support the Palestinian people's rights in terms of whatever way they want to do. It is our political responsibility. And some of these ways is indeed BDS, because it does work. It doesn't work overnight. But for us, for example, the disappointment, as you said, comrade, is our government. It is the fact that South Africa takes Israel to the ICJ, but they don't want to enforce a coal embargo. They don't want to cut diplomatic ties. And we are trading with Israel in diamonds, in grapes, and wine, I don't know what else. But for us, still, it is that we need to continue putting the pressure on our government. That is our responsibility, I believe. But I also think that we need to also be careful about how we conflate the issue about the humanitarian aid that is going on, that is necessary, but also, to a large extent, depoliticize the issue. And then we get the point where the Israeli state is not held accountable for the genocide. And the words are also important, because we must no longer call it a war and a conflict and those kind of things. So I just wanted to say that, and thank you for the timeless thing of your latest book.
Thank you, Abida, and we must take those matters up. Lynette, can I see you? There's a...
Hi. I speak with a very, very heavy chest, and I have a simple question. It is, what is the place of Hamas in the story? And I would like to know. I need to know. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you just introduce yourself and we take it from here?
Thank you. Thank you so much for this. I want to concur with Abida, who spoke first. And I think that everybody who sits here, all of us have changed since October the 7th. If you are human, you've changed. And the rage is never far from everything that I do since October the 7th. And I wanted to thank you for the space for remembering, always remembering Zanuka. I remember as a child, and I'm 54, my father was forcibly removed from Claremont, Harfield Village. And every year of my childhood, at the end of the year, he would take us. Some years he would drive by slowly, other years he would just sit and stare at the house. And so remembering is so important. If I can maybe just respond to the question, not on your behalf, but Hamas. You make mention in the 80s, when I was coming of age, that Margaret Thatcher and Reagan saw the ANC as a terrorist organization. We must not forget that Hamas in the early 2000s was elected in a democratic process. And political, I suppose, in the process, that is the story for the Palestinians, just like our relationship with the ANC is a South African story. And so to feed into some of these mainstream narratives and even questioning is to forget that there was a moment when Hamas was politically and democratically elected. Thank you.
Yes, at the back. May I come in? Yes. Thank you, sir. Thank you for the opportunity to listen to you, sir. Let me start by commenting to your reference to the to some South Africans acting as mercenaries. It's true, there are South Africans who are apologists of the Zionist state of Israel here in our midst. I have two questions for you. The first question is the role of the neighboring states, the Arab states, in this, you know, in this Palestinian struggle. What we see or what we hear is a state that is considered to be one of the poorest states coming to the aid, trying to intervene on behalf of the Palestinians, namely Yemeni. And yet there are so many rich Arab states that are just sitting back and watching. Some of them are even providing bases to both Israel and the Americans and NATO to see to it that the Zionists continue with their evil activities. Number two, what happened to the PLO, which has mutated into the Palestinian Authority? Where's the PLO? Where's the Palestinian Authority? Because the Zionists do not make a distinction between Hamas, PLO, or any other movement that may be there in Palestine, but their aim is to destroy Palestinians, regardless of their political hue or political allegiance. Those are my few questions. Lastly, it is not the first time that genocide is being committed in Palestine. As a young boy, I remember Shatila, I remember Sabra. For those who follow the Palestinian struggle, will know what happened in Lebanon during the early 1980s. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Haider deals with all those questions, and I'll give him a chance to yeah. do that. Two last questions.
Time.
yeah, but we started a little bit late. two last questions, Nati Rugobani, and then there's a young gentleman here.
Hi, Professor. Congratulations on your book, and thank you for the presentation. So my question is, I've had my fair share of aggressive backlash from the Zionist when I produced my two coloring books. And, you know, the recent one was in France, where the right-wing news has accused a bookstore that is selling From the River to the Sea, my coloring book, as Hamas propaganda. And it made me realize that apartheid Israel is very, very paranoid. And my question is, why are they so afraid of Palestinian voices? Thank you.
Dr. Haider. Since Hassan Kanafani wrote his short story, Knocking on the Walls of the Tanks, in 66, the image of the Palestinians trapped inside a sealed tank, bounding its walls with no reply, has remained a powerful symbol of abandonment. Decades later, in your book, Banging on the Walls of the Tank, reclaim the very same metaphor, this time not from a water tank, but the walls of Israeli tank besieging Gaza and crushing its children. Palestinian history appears as a closed circle. Different walls, the same cry, and the world remains deaf. So I have like a couple of questions on this point. To what extent does the sentence knocking on the wall metaphor from Kanafani to Haider Aid reveal the quantity of the Palestinian tragedy and the world failure to break the tank and open a life for and open a space for life and freedom and liberation? And can October 7 be understood as Palestinian attempt to break the wall after decades of knocking on the wall with no reply and not being heard? And did this act redefine the meaning of resistance before a world unwilling to listen? And last question, what is your thoughts on the Western leaders now wanting to acknowledge a Palestinian state? Is this a trap or finally justice? Thank you so much.
Thank you. Please go for it.
Oh, it's unfair. It's really unfair.
It's unfair. We'll bring you back again.
So I'll try to answer very briefly. I know you might not like some of the answers, but very, very briefly. Where is Hamas in the story? I mean, where is the PFLP in the story, which is a Marxist organization? Where is Fatah in the story, a secular nationalist organization? Why only Hamas? Do we know that Hamas was only established in 1987, at the beginning of the first Intifada? Before 1987, where was Hamas in the story? There was no Hamas. And this is a very direct answer. Second point is, you might not know that Hamas has in fact accepted the two-state solution. It changed its charter in 2017. I was in Gaza, I remember this very well. And I'm opposed to that. I'm completely opposed to that. I'm opposed to that. But I'm telling you that Hamas accepted the two-state solution. And the last point is that all Palestinian organizations are involved in the resistance in Gaza, but Western media only wants to see Hamas fighting back. So I think, you know, very, very direct. There was a point about, very quickly, I like the last, let me just go back to the point about banging on the walls of the tank. And I think it's a continuation of the same metaphor. In fact, when Ghassan Kanafani started writing his novella, which is the first Palestinian novella in the 20th century, he was in Kuwait. So the idea just crossed his mind, and then he started comparing the death. Actually, it happened. Three Palestinians were found dead in a tank. It happened, in actual. And then he thought about, you know, writing this novella, and it got published in the early 60s. And you know, if you know Palestinians, I'm sure, and people who are involved in the Palestinian Solidarity Movement know this very well. We have always been saying, well, we are banging on the walls. Why can't the world respond to our call for freedom? Long walk to freedom, as Mandela would call it. So I think it's a continuity. The world is deaf, definitely. We have been banging on the walls of the tank. The last point, PLOPA, there is a difference, a huge difference between the Palestine Liberation Organization and the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Liberation Organization was established in 1964 to represent all components of the Palestinian people. all Palestinians. The Palestinian Authority is one of the institutions of the Oslo Accords, which were signed back in 1993, to represent only one third of the Palestinian people, those who live in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. What do we think about the PLO? We think there is corruption. We think that the PLO needs to be reconstructed in order to represent all Palestinian organizations, including Hamas, Islamic Jihad, PFLP, and the FLP. Am I missing out something else?
Yeah.
Because of time, actually.
Yeah. Okay. And there are many other issues which were raised here, which is in the book. Read the book around here as well. But we're definitely going to call Haider Eid again. This is not doing justice, as you said. We're going to. You've got a chapter in the book, except in terms of the title of the book. Hassan Kanafi says it as a question mark. Why didn't you bang?
Yes.
You don't have a question mark. You say bang.
Bang. Yeah. Of course, we try to answer.
Thank you. We're going to spend. There's a chapter in your book. What's to be done? Can we spend the last 5 minutes in terms of all the range of questions and the book in terms of what's
no,
to be done?
No, he said.
Okay, in which case I'm going to summarize saying that we reiterate the calls in the book for a right to self-determination of the Palestinians, the right to resistance, the right to return, and the right to reparations. And encapsulated in that is what that is for is to, as we fight for the unity of the land, the unity of the resistance, and the unity of its people, for a Palestine to be free from the river to the sea. Buy the book. There'll be an opportunity for your other questions with the book signing event over next door. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This event was made possible by the support of the City of Cape Town, the Heinrich Bull Foundation, and the Wheatfield Estate Foundation Trust.